From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
After they found no evidence that Iraq has revived its nuclear weapon program since the elimination of the program in the 1990s. However, our work is steadily progressing and should be allowed to run its natural course. These few months, in my view, would be a valuable investment in peace because they could help us avoid a war.
Mohammed Al-Bardeh, the chief nuclear weapons inspector, and Hans Blix, the chief UN weapons inspector, deliver their reports to the United Nations. The U.S. responds.
The issue is not how much more time the inspectors need to search in the dark. It is how much more time Iraq should be given to turn on the lights and to come clean. And the answer is not much more time.
And we'll get our own response.
It's time for the Bush administration to turn some of its own light on by putting the alleged evidence on the table instead of painting these reports as unremittingly dark.
Then journalist Seymour Hersh on what the administration knew about Pakistan and the North Korean nuclear program. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The chief Iraqi weapons inspectors reported to the UN Security Council yesterday that Iraq has failed to fully cooperate with inspections, but also says there is no new evidence Iraq has weapons of mass destruction. Chief Nuclear Inspector Mohammed Al-Bardeh requested that inspectors be given several more months to complete their work. He said if the inspectors were given more time, it could prevent war. However, British Foreign Secretary Jack Straw today claimed Iraq is in material breach of the UN resolution. And in Washington, Secretary of State General Colin Powell said there's little time left to resolve the situation peacefully. The Washington Post is reporting the Bush administration plans to declassify intelligence information that shows Iraq has moved and hid banned weapons from UN inspectors. President Bush will address the nation tonight in his State of the Union address and meet with British Prime Minister Tony Blair on Friday. Outside the United Nations yesterday, police arrested 21 peace protesters. Demonstrators also rallied in front of the German mission to urge Germany to continue to speak out against war. Meanwhile, the Washington Post is reporting General Norman Schwarzkopf wants to give peace a chance. The general who commanded U.S. forces in the 91 Gulf War says he hasn't seen enough evidence to convince him that his old comrades Dick Cheney, Colin Powell, and Paul Wolfowitz are correct in moving toward a new war now. He thinks UN inspections are still the proper course to follow. He's worried about the cockiness of U.S. war plan and even more by the potential human and financial costs of occupying Iraq. And the Washington Post reports, Norman Schwarzkopf believes War Secretary Donald Rumsfeld's presence on TV is, quote, scary. He says Rumsfeld, quote, almost sometimes seems to be enjoying it. 41 U.S. Nobel laureates in science and economics yesterday issued a declaration opposing a so-called preventative war against Iraq without wide international support. The statement reads, quote, even with a victory, we believe the medical, environmental, moral, spiritual, political, and legal consequences of an American preventative attack on Iraq would undermine, not protect, U.S. security and standing in the world. The signers, all men, include an architect of the atomic bomb, a Manhattan Project scientist who readied the Hiroshima bomb and later advised NATO, and former Pentagon advisors. In Porto Alegre, Brazil, the World Social Forum came to a close with a massive protest against a U.S. invasion of Iraq and the U.S.-backed proposal to expand NAFTA to the entire Western Hemisphere. The Greenpeace ship Rainbow Warrior yesterday blocked a major British military supply port in protest of Britain's plans to help Washington invade Iraq. And in Pittsburgh, 5,000 people marched under a steady snowfall on Sunday in the culmination of a weekend of anti-war events. Newsweek is reporting FBI Director Robert Mueller's top aides have ordered field supervisors to develop, quote, demographic profiles of their localities, including tallying the number of mosques and Muslims. Those profiles will then be used, along with other factors, to set specific numerical goals for counterterrorism investigations and secret national security wiretaps in each region. Top Bureau officials have signaled that if field offices don't meet their pre-established goals, they may be subjected to special reviews by inspection teams from headquarters. The ACLU told the New York Times, the survey is, quote, tailor-made for a witch hunt and compared the order to the ethnic census information collected in World War II, a precursor to the internment of Japanese Americans. The Bush administration has yet to comment publicly about its support of quotas when it comes to tallying Muslims and mosques around the country. Israeli troops invaded Jenin and Gaza today, killing seven Palestinians. A photographer from Agence France-Presse was shot in the leg. Israeli troops have locked down the entire West Bank and Gaza Strip for Israel's general election today. Prime Minister General Ariel Sharon is predicted to defeat the new leader of the Labor Party, Amram Mitzna. Mitzna had pledged to withdraw troops from the Gaza Strip within a year. 6 weeks after a judge overturned the rape convictions of five teenagers in the 1989 Central Park jogger case, the New York City Police Department has released a report concluding the teens most likely assaulted the jogger. The convictions were thrown out at the district attorney's request after serial rapist Matias Reyes came forward and confessed to the crime. DNA tests corroborated his confession. The police report said Reyes may have been motivated by prison threats or a desire to be transferred to a different prison. The report insisted there is, quote, nothing but his uncorroborated word that he acted alone. Many have contested the police report, saying they have put it out to defend themselves in possible future lawsuits. The retired firefighter President Bush put his arm around while standing atop the World Trade Center rubble after September 11th is boycotting the president's State of the Union address tonight. Instead, Bob Beckwith will be protesting outside, calling for the release of $90 million in federal aid to monitor the long-term health of Ground Zero workers. Over half of Ground Zero workers still have ear, nose, and throat ailments and post-traumatic stress disorder, according to preliminary findings released yesterday. Only 3,500 workers have been examined under the federal screening program. An estimated 30,000 took part in the rescue and cleanup efforts. The independent commission investigating the September 11th attacks met yesterday for the first time. The meeting was held behind closed doors because Congress has exempted the committee from federal open meeting laws. The government has given the commission just $3 million and 16 months to explore the causes and responses to 9/11. The Associated Press notes this is $2 million and 4 months less than the government gave a 1996 federal commission to study legalized gambling. And seven families of people killed in the attack on the World Trade Center have sued the head of the September 11th Victims Fund, Kenneth Feinberg. All the families involved in the lawsuit are related to victims who worked for the stockbroking firm Cantor Fitzgerald. They say Feinberg put an illegal cap on the awards and discriminated against unmarried people. In particular, they say Feinberg has, quote, played a cat and mouse game when it comes to figuring awards for victims who earn more than $231,000 a year. The plaintiff's lawyer says Feinberg has been loath to offer awards of more than $5 or $6 million. If successful, the lawsuit could force Feinberg to pay out hundreds of millions of dollars, if not billions more, than the $5 billion the fund is expected to cost taxpayers. And today is the 150th anniversary of the birth of José Martí.
Oh, I'm sounding drums of war, said the man at his desk. Oh, I will not fight your war, said the child, and he stood, and he stood, and he stood, and we're well that he stood. Oh, I will not fight your war, said the child, and he stood. Oh, but don't you love your country, said the man at his desk.
Yes, I do, but you don't,
said the child, and he stood. And he stood, and he stood.
good, and to will that is good.
I do, but you don't,
said the child, and he stood.
Stefan Smith, The Bell, here on Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In a pair of reports to the UN Security Council, the chief weapons inspectors reported that Iraq had failed to fully cooperate, but said there's no new evidence that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction. Chief Nuclear Inspector Mohammed El-Baradei requested that inspectors be given several more months to complete their work. Chief Inspector Hans Blix said, quote, Iraq appears not to have come to a genuine acceptance, not even today, of the disarmament which was demanded of it and which it needs to carry out to win the confidence of the world and to live in peace. But Blix went on to say that it is too early to tell if Iraq has disarmed or not. To date, inspectors have carried out 300 inspections to more than 230 different sites, including universities, military bases, presidential sites, and private homes. The searches have produced no smoking guns. El-Baradei said his inspectors have found no evidence that Iraq had resumed the nuclear program it discontinued in the early 1990s. The Bush administration says the report proves Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein does not want to cooperate. And Secretary of State General Colin Powell warned time is running out for Iraq. White House spokesperson Ari Fleischer dismissed the work of the inspectors, saying it would take them another 300 years to complete a full inspection. To help its case, the Bush administration is planning to declassify what it says are some intelligence information that shows Iraq has moved and hid banned weapons from inspectors. The international response has been mixed. Representatives from France, Russia, China, and Germany said the reports demonstrated that inspections are working and should be allowed to continue. Meanwhile, British Foreign Secretary Jack Straw said for the first time Iraq was in material breach of UN demands for it to disarm. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan added inspectors need more time to get their work done. Meanwhile, in Washington, top Democrat Senate Minority Leader Tom Daschle and his House counterpart, Congressmember Nancy Pelosi, charged that Bush has yet to make the case for war against Iraq. We're going to hear first from Chief UN Weapons Inspector Hans Blix. While much of the media has focused on his comment that Iraq has not come to genuine acceptance of disarmament, Blix's full statement was more nuanced. He said Iraq has cooperated in many areas. He added there's no smoking gun that proves Iraq has weapons of mass destruction. After that, we'll hear from Mohammed El-Baradei. We'll hear from General Colin Powell. We'll hear from the South African ambassador to the United Nations, who heads the non-aligned movement, as well as the Iraqi ambassador to the United Nations. And then Phyllis Bennis will be joining us along with Andres Zumach to analyze the reports. Finally, we'll talk to Seymour Hersh about North Korea, its nuclear program, and its relation to a U.S.-backed Pakistan. First to Hans Blix.
I shall deal first with cooperation on process. In this regard, it has regard to the procedures, mechanism, infrastructure, and practical arrangements to pursue inspections and seek verifiable disarmament. While inspection is not built on the premise of confidence, but may lead to confidence if it is successful, there must nevertheless be a measure of mutual confidence from the very beginning in running the operation of inspection. Iraq has, on the whole, cooperated rather well so far with UNMOVIC in this field. The most important point to make is that access has been provided to all sites we have wanted to inspect, and with one exception, it has been prompt. We have further had a great help in building up the infrastructure of our office in Baghdad and the field office in Mosul. Arrangements and services for our plane and our helicopters have been good. The environment has been workable. Our inspections have included universities, military bases, presidential sites, and private residences. Inspections have also taken place on Fridays, the Muslim Day of Rest, on Christmas Day and New Year's Day. These inspections have been conducted in the same manner as all other inspections. We seek to be both effective and correct. In this updating, I'm bound, however, to register some problems, firstly relating to two kinds of air operations. While we now have the technical capability to send a U-2 plane placed at our disposal for aerial imagery and for surveillance during inspections, and have informed Iraq that we plan to do so. Iraq has refused to guarantee its safety unless a number of conditions are fulfilled. As these conditions went beyond what is stipulated in Resolution 1441 and what was practiced by UNSCOM and Iraq in the past, we note that Iraq is not so far complying with our request. I hope this attitude will change. Another air operation problem, which was solved during our recent talks in Baghdad, concerned the use of helicopters flying into the no-fly zones. Iraq had insisted on sending helicopters of their own to accompany ours. This would have raised a safety problem. The matter was solved by an offer on our part to take the accompanying Iraqi minders in our helicopters to the sites, an arrangement that had been practiced by UNSCOM in the past. I'm obliged to note some recent disturbing incidents and harassment. For instance, for some time, far-fetched allegations have been made publicly that questions posed by inspectors were of an intelligence character. While I might not defend every question that inspectors might have asked, Iraq knows that they do not serve intelligence purposes, and Iraq should not say so. On a number of occasions, demonstrations have taken place in front of our offices and at inspection sites. The other day, a sightseeing excursion by five inspectors to a mosque was followed by an unwarranted public outburst. The inspectors went without UN insignia and were welcomed in the kind manner that is characteristic of the normal Iraqi attitude to foreigners. They took off their shoes and were taken around. They asked perfectly innocent questions and parted with the invitation to come again. Shortly thereafter, we received protests from the Iraqi authorities about an unannounced inspection and about questions not relevant to weapons of mass destruction. Indeed, they were not. Demonstrations and outbursts of this kind are unlikely to occur in Iraq without initiative or encouragement from the authorities. We must ask ourselves what the motives may be for these events. They do not facilitate an already difficult job in which we try to be effective, professional, and at the same time correct. Where our Iraqi counterparties have some complaint, they can take it up in a calmer and less unpleasant manner. The substantive cooperation required relates above all to the obligation of Iraq to declare all programs of weapons of mass destruction and either to present items and activities for elimination or else to provide evidence supporting the conclusions that nothing proscribed remains. Paragraph 9 of Resolution 1441 states that this cooperation shall be, quote-unquote, active. It is not enough to open doors. Inspection is not a game of catch-as-catch-can. Rather, as I noted, it is a process of verification for the purpose of creating confidence. It is not built upon the premise of trust. Rather, it is designed to lead to trust. If there is both openness to the inspectors and action to present them with items to destroy, or credible evidence about the absence of any such items.
UN Weapons Inspector Hans Blix addressing the United Nations yesterday. And interestingly, not on the front page of the New York Times, but on page A9, was the headline, Findings of UN Group Undercut U.S. Assertion. It says the International Atomic Energy Agency's report that Iraq has not resumed its nuclear program has challenged one of the Bush administration's main arguments for taking military action to topple the Iraqi government. When the administration began to outline its case in late summer, it argued that Iraq was trying to rejuvenate its nuclear program, a development that could change the balance of power in the Persian Gulf and significantly heighten the threat to the United States. The report that the chief inspectors presented to the Security Council strengthened the administration's claims that Iraq has failed to actively cooperate with the UN disarmament demands, that it has not facilitated interviews with its scientists or resolved major discrepancies about its biological, chemical, and missile programs. At the same time, however, a report by the Atomic Energy Agency ran counter to repeated Bush administration claims that Iraq has resumed its nuclear efforts. We go now to the chief nuclear weapons inspector, Mohammed al-Baradei.
Inspections are time-consuming. I should mention that even in the case of South Africa, where full and active cooperation was forthcoming, it took the IAEA about 2 years to complete the process in that country. If inspection, however, is successful, it can ensure disarmament through peaceful means. It is worth recalling that in our past experience in Iraq, the elimination of its nuclear weapon program was mostly accomplished through intrusive inspection. It is also worth recalling that the presence of international inspectors in Iraq today continues to serve as an effective deterrence to an insurance against resumption of programs to develop weapons of mass destruction, even as we continue to look for possible past activities. Mr. President, to conclude, we have to date found no evidence that Iraq has revived its nuclear weapon program since the elimination of the program in the 1990s. However, our work is steadily progressing and should be allowed to run its natural course. With our verification system now in place, barring exceptional circumstances, and provided there is a sustained proactive cooperation by Iraq, we should be able, within the next few months, to provide credible assurance that Iraq has no nuclear weapon program. These few months, in my view, would be a valuable investment in peace because they could help us avoid a war. We trust that we will continue to have your support as we make every effort to verify Iraq's nuclear disarmament through peaceful means and to demonstrate that the inspection process can and does work as a central feature of the international nuclear arms control regime.
Mohammed Al-Baradei, the chief UN nuclear weapons inspector. We're going to break. When we come back, we'll hear from General Colin Powell at the State Department, then the South African ambassador to the United Nations. Stay with us.
They call the place to you, United Nations. Yeah, oh, another animal talk. Within United, inside United Nations. Who and who unite for United Nations? Nobody Atasha and Argentina Day. Nobody Aragon and Libya Day. Israel versus Lebanon. Iranio versus Iraqi. East-West Bloc versus West Bloc East. Nobody them the whole United Nations. United, United Nations. One veto vote is equal to 92.
Or more.
We can sense be that.
Beast of No Nation, Fela Kuti, here on Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report as we turn to General Colin Powell, Secretary of State, responding to the UN report at the State Department yesterday. Sound.
Iraq appears not to have come to a genuine acceptance, not even today, of the disarmament that was demanded of it, unquote. Let me repeat, because this is the essence of the problem. Dr. Blix said, Iraq appears not to have come to a genuine acceptance, not even today, of the disarmament that was demanded of it. 1441 is all about the disarmament demanded of Iraq. The inspector's findings came as no surprise. For 11 years before 1441, Saddam Hussein's regime refused to make the strategic decision, the political decision, to disarm itself of weapons of mass destruction and to comply with the world's demands. To this day, the Iraq regime continues to defy the will of the United Nations. The Iraq regime has responded to 1441 with empty claims, empty declarations, and empty gestures. It has not given the inspectors and the international community any concrete information in answer to a host of key questions. Where is the missing anthrax? This is not just a question of historical curiosity. It is essential for us to know what happened to this deadly material. Where is the VX? Also not just a trivial question. We must know what happened to this deadly material. Where are the chemical and biological munitions? Where are the mobile biological laboratories? If the Iraqi regime was truly committed to disarmament, we wouldn't be looking for these mobile labs. They drive them up and park them in front of UNMOVIC headquarters for inspection. Why is Iraq violating the restrictions on ballistic missiles? Why is it violating the ban on missiles with a range of more than 150 kilometers? Where are the credible, verifiable answer to all of the other disarmament questions compiled by the previous inspectors?
General Colin Powell speaking at the Department of State yesterday. As the U.S. administration beat the drums for war, others at the United Nations were much more cautious. Dumisani Khumalo, South African ambassador to the U.N., also head of the non-aligned movement, came out to speak with reporters after the U.N. weapons inspectors delivered their report.
The non-aligned movement does not believe in war. In fact, the United Nations was founded as an organization of peace. What we would like to do is allow first the inspectors to do their work. If the inspectors come back to the Security Council and say, we're giving up, it's not working, we're obstructed all the way, the resolution requires the Security Council to then take a decision. But what we are saying is that 60 days, and it's only been less than a month since I've had 12 helicopters, so they are now beginning to go around the country. This is not the time to then start and saying, you've done enough, we're going to move away. So we're saying allow the process and then make the decision.
What
will it take
to convince you that Iraq is not cooperating?
What will convince me that Iraq is not cooperating would be when Dr. Blix comes there and Dr. Al-Baradei and say, we're giving up, Iraq is not cooperating. They didn't say that. I was in there. That's why we asked for an open meeting so we could actually be able to answer this question. They didn't say that. In fact, Dr. Al-Baradei went even further and said, we need as much time as it will take for us to complete the work. Yes, Dr. Blix said those are the areas that he still wants to go and investigate further. So he didn't say because of those areas I'm giving up. He said I'm listing all these areas where there are inconsistencies, I want to go back in the coming months and double-check on them.
Dumisani Khumalo, South African ambassador to the United Nations, head of the non-aligned movement. After we listen to Iraqi ambassador to the United Nations, Mohammed Al-Duri, we will speak with Phyllis Bennis and Andres Zumak about the scene yesterday at the United Nations, as well as specifically the UN response to the U.S. response to the UN report. We go now to Iraqi Ambassador to the United Nations, Mohammed Al-Duri.
In less than 2 months, more than 440 inspections were carried out to more than 297 sites, which included presidential sites. Now there are 237 inspectors and officials from UNMOVIC and IAEA in Iraq. All the sites that the United States and Britain alleged in their two recent reports that were producing weapons of mass destruction were repeatedly inspected, X-rayed, and environmental samples were taken to make sure that nothing happened there. The result to prove that Iraq is clear of weapons of mass destruction. The inspectors also proved that all the intelligence information provided later by the United States and Britain and satellite pictures were baseless. By doing so, the only way out for the United States and Britain was to resort to the so-called remaining disarmament issues by claiming that not resolving these issues is a material breach to Resolution 1441. Everybody knows that any legal or logical reading of Resolution 1441 contradicts that. We should keep in mind that this Security Council that includes the U.S. and Britain laid down a resolution 1284, the mechanism of dealing with the remaining disarmament issues, and that the Security Council disarmament panel stated in 1999 that these remaining disarmament issues could be dealt with after the suspension of sanctions within the future ongoing monitoring in Iraq. In spite of this fact, Iraq provided new information in this declaration and has expressed his sincere willingness to clarify any questions and work out solving these issues. No country in the world has disarmed as Iraq did between 1991-1998.
Mohammed Al-Duri, the Iraqi ambassador to the United Nations, and you are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, as we go now to our guest back again from yesterday, Phyllis Bennis, fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. Her latest book, is Before and After U.S. Foreign Policy and the September 11th Crisis, and Andreas Zumach, Geneva-based U.N. correspondent with the German newspaper Die Tageszeitung. We welcome you both to Democracy Now!. Your response to the Blix and Al-Baradei reports. First, Phyllis.
I think, Amy, that the U.S. response to the reports gives us more indication, if we need it anymore, that the Bush administration is not making its decisions about war or peace in Iraq having anything to do with what the inspectors have found or not found on the ground. It has nothing to do with the question of weapons of mass destruction. There's an eerie parallel that we're seeing right now to a much earlier version of this same incident in 1998, when the U.S. essentially cooked up a crisis with the earlier weapons inspectors called UNSCOM, just before the massive bombing campaign of December of 1998 against Iraq. There was a report issued, and the chair of UNSCOM, Richard Butler, issued a report that was absolutely apocalyptic in tone, claiming that there was no way that the inspectors could go forward, that they were being kept from their work. The actual language of the report didn't reflect that at all. It said that Iraq was cooperating with the majority of inspections, that there were a few instances of noncompliance, but they were by far the minority in this larger framework of full cooperation.
Was that the same report that Richard Butler had been holed up with U.S. officials
exactly.
in New York?
Exactly.
Writing?
And it raises the question of who wrote the opening lines of these reports? Who wrote those lines that Colin Powell just repeated over and over again yesterday? With this line about Iraq has not accepted the notion of cooperation with the inspectors, when in fact the report itself is far more nuanced than that. It is true that the Blix report is more critical of Iraq than the report of Mohammed Al-Baradei, but it's not nearly as qualitatively damaging as the slogans and the concluding words would have us believe. It simply doesn't match up. And it has to raise the question again of what were the pressures put on Hans Blix in drafting this report, and who else participated in the drafting of the report.
It seemed that Hans Blix's report was missing the conclusions that they had said to him, then just state what you have experienced as opposed to what he had been putting forward for quite a while, which was, and so we need the weapons inspections to continue. Now, Andreas Zumach, Mohammed Al-Baradei did share those conclusions.
Yes, but this has to do with the fact that the areas the both men are responsible for are somewhat different. In the nuclear field, we did have a somewhat clean slate since 1998. The final report of IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Organization of this time, said that the nuclear weapons program has been dismantled and that there is no indication that Iraq is planning a new one. So that's much easier from the starting point, while Mr. Blix has to deal with chemical weapons, biological weapons, missiles, and there are much more open questions that had been left from back then. But I want to shed some more light on what Phyllis was indicating. We do know that there was heavy pressure up till the very last minute before the drafting of these two separate reports by these two gentlemen, heavy pressure by the U.S. We do know that the two men didn't even have the chance to exchange beforehand what they would say yesterday in the council, so they wouldn't know. I am saying that because lots has been made yesterday among journalists at the UN out of the fact that Baradei very clearly said explicitly, we need many more months of inspections, while Blix did not in such explicit term stress the need for more time. I think too much has been interpreted into that. And secondly, I want to shed some light on one important statement we also heard by Blix in the excerpt, but where everybody is asking what's behind that. And this is the issue of the U-2 espionage planes. Blix only said Iraq is refusing that and setting conditions. But what is the condition? The main condition is that the Iraqi government is saying, we are not in principle against the U-2s. We are against them as long as at the same time U.S. and British fighter jets are flying over Iraq and bombing regularly. And as long as they are doing it, we cannot give the guarantee to the U.N. that our anti-aircraft is not accidentally shooting at a U-2 while actually aiming at one of the British and American planes. And I think this is a concern which at least is so of such a political nature that the Security Council should sit down about that and think about whether they should give new instructions to UNMOVIC and maybe clearing this obstacle. I think as far as I know, the Security Council in the closed meeting did not do that yesterday, but there are some member countries who at least play with the idea to bring that up.
On the issue of Mohammed al-Baradei and the emphasis that his report has gotten, President Bush has been using so-called evidence of a nuclear program over the last months to build up the war fever. When he went to the UN in September to make his case against Iraq, he said that he was bringing a rare piece of evidence for what he called Iraq's continued appetite for nuclear bombs. The finding, Iraq had tried to buy thousands of high-strength aluminum tubes, which Bush said were used to enrich uranium for a nuclear weapon. But al-Baradei had a very different message yesterday, Phyllis.
Absolutely. I mean, this is what has been reported before, but was stated very conclusively yesterday by Mohammed al-Baradei, that the aluminum tubes, which were such a feature of the Bush administration's claims with such fear-mongering that Iraq is trying to rebuild its nuclear weapons capacity, and here we have proof because they've imported these aluminum tubes. Well, it turns out that the aluminum tubes are not consistent with being used for a nuclear weapon system at all, that they're consistent with a conventional weapon system, which is what Iraq had said they were bringing them in for. And it raises, again, this issue because now, despite the conclusion of the International Atomic Energy Agency, there has been no pullback from the Bush administration, no new acknowledgement that, oh, perhaps we were wrong on at least this one point. And it's being dealt with in an extraordinarily biased way. If we look at the New York Times coverage, for instance, this morning, a huge banner headline on page one, focusing on Blix's report and its conclusions that Iraq is not fully accepting the disarmament process. It's not till we get to page A9, a very small headline on the side that says, findings of UN group undercut U.S. assertion. Doesn't even mention that it's the International Atomic Energy Agency. Doesn't mention that it's the challenge here is the challenge to the heart of the Bush administration's effort to convince Americans and convince the world that there is a basis on which there's a legitimacy to go to war, that whole claim was undercut by al-Baradei's conclusions, that there was no evidence. They have found no evidence of a resumption of Iraq's nuclear weapons programs.
Andrei Sumak.
Two little more details on that. The other specific claim the Bush administration and the British government made since September was that Iraq supposedly tried to buy fissile material for nuclear weapons somewhere in an African country. Later it turned out it was meant to be Niger or Niger. Baradei says in his report, we as inspectors on the ground in Iraq could not verify that. That's not possible. And the problem is, he says explicitly in his report, that the U.S. has not so far given us any intelligence they claim to have, where we could start on and try to check it out whether it's true or not. And the second thing is, in the meantime, we had the search of the house of one former nuclear scientist, and the inspectors found 2,000 pages. As it turns out, these were not relating to an actual today nuclear weapons program, but they were referring to the nuclear weapons program that they had till 1991. But again, it's being used right now as alleged proof for a new nuclear weapons program by the Bush administration.
And what about other allegations of John Negroponte, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, and Colin Powell, the report he delivered to the State Department? He talked about anthrax, talked about mobile weapons, talked about VX, he talked about a lot of things.
This was once again, Amy, an effort by the Bush administration, and this is new, I would say, for Colin Powell. He has not in the past participated in this fear-mongering. Negroponte, of course, is an old hand at it, as are a number of others in the Bush administration. But this has been
Negroponte, the former U.S. ambassador to Honduras and supporter of the Contras.
Right, and current U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. This is the practice of putting forward this claim that, quote, we have evidence, but we can't show you. Colin Powell yesterday actually said that the Iraqis need to turn on the lights, not keep us in the dark. Well, it seems to me it's the U.S. that needs to shed some light on this. They're making these claims day in and day out to whip up a war fever. So far, even that propaganda hasn't worked. But they have yet to provide one shred of evidence.
They say they will in the coming days.
They say they will. They've said that before. 2 weeks ago, they said, in the coming days, we will provide some new evidence. The new evidence turned out to be another repeat of the claim about the aluminum tubes. Then they started to be quiet on that, although they never acknowledged that that was actually just stated to be flat out wrong by the International Atomic Energy Agency. They are simply not prepared to provide this. So what they do is keep saying the words, where is the anthrax, which we should note, of course, U.S. corporations, the American Type Culture Collection, sold to Iraq in the 1980s. Where is the VX? Where are the missiles? As if by saying it over and over again, they will just drum it into the heads of the American people and people all around the world that it's true that Iraq has these things. Iraq says, yeah, we had these things. They were destroyed. They were rendered harmless. And the question now is there documentation available to prove all of that? For some of it, there simply may not be. For others, there may still be more documentation that needs to be found. But there has been no evidence provided, not a shred, by the United States, not in a public arena and not privately to the inspectors. They have given some evidence to the inspectors, apparently, but none of it has shown any evidence of a current viable weapons program.
Andre Sinla.
And if now, after 61 days of inspections, all of a sudden the U.S. government would come forward with convincing proof, then certainly the whole world would ask the legitimate question, why only now? Why let the inspectors running around blind for 61 days and then put material on the table that would be very useful for the inspectors in the very beginning? But let's come back to the issue whether inspections could resolve the problem or not. And I say yes. It might well be, and we talked about that yesterday in detail, that all these questions that refer to alleged former capacities, biological, chemical weapons, or precursors for that, cannot be resolved in a manner that Iraq is able to prove that they actually destroyed, because there might not be any documents to prove that. So the only chance here is to have inspections long enough and thoroughly enough to really look through under every stone and every car, as Colin Powell said it on Sunday in Davos, to see whether there's anything left. And that's possible. To give us an idea of what that takes, the South African ambassador yesterday, Dumisane Khumalo, said something very important that gives us a criteria what it takes. It's not 300 years, that's propaganda. But he said, when my South African government in 1994 admitted to the illegal nuclear weapons program the apartheid regime started in the early 70s, it took the International Atomic Energy Agency 2 years to finally verify that we have given it up. So much more work has to be done in Iraq compared to this little what had to be done in South Africa. So it takes at least another 6-8 months.
And finally, what about the U.S. saying that it is up to Iraq to disarm? Inspectors are not the disarmers.
This is one of the key challenges here. The U.S. position is we have no responsibility and the inspectors have no responsibility to find anything, that only Iraq has the responsibility to come forward and provide the evidence, that it's not up to the inspectors to prove anything. Iraq must prove the negative. Iraq must prove what it does not have. There's a certain logic to that, on one hand. You can say that they are the country that was being sanctioned for an illegal war, and therefore they should have to prove that they no longer have these weapons. The problem is they have put forward what they have. They have put forward their proof and said, here's the evidence we have that these weapons no longer exist. At that point, if anyone else, like the United States, wants to come forward and say, we don't believe that evidence, we don't accept it, we don't think it's sufficient, then they have the burden. That maybe the Iraqis had the burden early on, but they met that burden. They provided what they provided. If anyone is now saying that's not enough, then they do have the burden coming back to them to say, put your proof on the table. Where's the proof?
Well, we'll see what happens in the coming days. 10 seconds, Andrei Sumak.
Well, I would add, though, there are some questions Iraq could answer, at least on the charges about the missiles, which are stemming from the more recent last 3 or 4 years, and where there certainly will be documents. And these questions about the flight tests could be answered satisfyingly by Baghdad.
Andrei Sumak and Phyllis Bennis. Andrei Sumak is a reporter for usually based in Geneva, covering the United Nations for the German newspaper Die. Why don't you pronounce it yourself?
Die Tageszeitung, which simply means the daily paper.
And Phyllis Bennis, I can pronounce that. Institute for Policy Studies, and her book is called Before and After. Thank you very much for being with us. When we come back, Seymour Hersh will talk about the cold test, what the administration knew about Pakistan and the North Korean nuclear program. Stay with us.
By the river. In a little tent, oh, and just like the river I've been running ever since. Oh, it's been a long time coming, but I know change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. It's been too hard living, but I'm afraid to die, 'cause I don't know what's up there beyond the sky. Oh, it's been a
Neville Brothers, Change is Going to Come. You are listening to Democracy Now! I am Amy Goodman. Latest news, North Korea is accusing the United States of planning a massive military attack and said the situation on the Korean Peninsula is deteriorating rapidly. The North state-run news agency said the U.S. forces in South Korea and the South Korean military have put together a contingency plan to invade the North and are preparing to put it into action. The plan includes attacks against the North's nuclear facilities. We took a look at the last week's article in the New Yorker magazine called The Cold Test, What the Administration Knew About Pakistan and the North Korean Nuclear Program by Seymour Hersh. As the U.S. continues to offer to say that the U.S. is going to attack Iraq partly because of developing a nuclear program, what about North Korea? Seymour Hersh, welcome to Democracy Now!
Hello.
Can you talk about your findings?
Well, what I wrote about was simply that in June of last year, the American Intelligence Community, the CIA, pulled together all of the various strands of information in the agencies and wrote what they call an estimate, a national intelligence estimate, sort of a highly classified document, in fact, a very highly classified document, that said, that told the president and anybody else who wanted to read it, that indeed North Korea had been cheating on the agreement that was signed in the Clinton administration, which, you know, stopping their production of plutonium. But the North Koreans had begun, had honored that part. They stopped the making of plutonium or fissile grade plutonium that could be used in a warhead. They had done that. But in 97, the North Koreans began to go after a nuclear bomb by a different method, enriched uranium. And the finding was pretty clear and definitive, and more significantly, the most significant aspect of it was that Pakistan, which at the time last summer was certainly one of our leading allies in the war against terrorism, Pakistan had been the enabler, more or less, the nuclear enabler. They had, beginning in 97, 98, started funneling machinery, prototypes, test results, including a cold test, which is a test of a warhead, which is a test of a warhead without using natural uranium that can get you almost the same results you would get if you had a real enrich uranium and get a real nuclear reaction. So basically, they handed them the bomb. And the only thing that was fascinating to me about the report was that the official story the Bush people put out was that last October, a man named Assistant Secretary of State named Kelly traveled to North Korea, to Pyongyang, and at a meeting there told the North Koreans what we know, and the North Koreans, quote-unquote, confessed. Well, it seems clear that the information was certainly at least 4 months older than that, and that the whole sort of story of how we learned about North Korea was just that, a story. And it seemed clear that, I guess it's pretty obvious, that the fixation the administration had with Iraq, even last summer, precluded them from doing anything about North Korea, when it's arguable that North Korea is certainly far more advanced than Iraq in terms of nuclear weaponry and much more of a threat.
Seymour Hersh, you write that the Pakistani economy had foundered in 1997. There was no more money to pay for North Korean missile support, Pakistan getting missiles from North Korea. So the Pakistani government began paying for missiles by providing some of the know-how and the specifics. And you suggest that it may well be that a number of Pakistani scientists have basically moved to North Korea to develop the program.
Well, I can't say that. I suggest it's probably as good as you can do. What you can say is that one particular, the head of one of the laboratories, a scientist named A.Q. Khan, was tracked by American intelligence, making no less than 13 trips back and forth. And some Pakistani scientists with technical skills have left the country. We don't know where they are. We don't know they're in North Korea, though. They could be anywhere. They could be in Indonesia. What's really alarming about this is this, in a funny way, outside of North Korea, is that the one fear of arms controllers is that a third world country would develop an indigenous capability to make nuclear weapons and not need anything from America or the Brits or the Chinese, and just be able to do it on their own. And then this country, in turn, would begin to proliferate, would spread the knowledge among its allies. And here you have, you know, oh horror, the Islamic bomb in Pakistan, an Islamic country, and there is a lot of evidence that they pass it on to North Korea. I will tell you, there's reason to think that people in Pakistan are talking to other countries in the world, and that's very alarming. That's a huge jump in the risk and the dangers, and it does sort of, I'll anticipate your next question, it does sort of reduce the Iraqi threat enormously in a funny way, because the North Korea-Pakistan situation is so much more immediate and real than the potential threat from Iraq.
You describe George Bush's almost uncontainable loathing of Kim Jong-il. Yet despite this, and despite the CIA report, which was released in June, which stated that North Korea had the means to produce weapons-grade enriched uranium, on July 5th, Condoleezza Rice made it clear in a letter to certain Congress members that the U.S. would continue providing North Korea with shipments of heavy fuel oil and nuclear technology for two promised energy-generating reactors.
Well, I mean, obviously, there's two ways to look at it. One, of course, is the NIE comes in June, the National Intelligence Estimate, that tells them what they don't want to know. And you could argue that they didn't have time to reach a policy, so what she was doing was continuing the policy that this is a Clinton program, to give them heavy fuel oil and to build some light water, more reactors that presumably could be much more harder to divert plutonium from, light water reactors. That was the program that the Clinton administration, sort of the blackmail they agreed to in 94 with the North Koreans to stop them from doing plutonium enrichment. Anyway, but the problem you have with thinking that is that, of course, whatever the CIA reported in June was just a compilation of what was known. We probably knew in the same article, I think I write, that outgoing Clinton administration officials had their doubts. They began to realize that the North Koreans were cheating and doing enriched uranium, and they briefed that to the Bush people. So the Bush administration certainly had more than a year and a half of warning that North Korea was up to something. One can also note that getting a report, once you get a report, you have to act on it, and she should have done. At that point, it would have been more prudent, it seems to me, for the Bush administration. I quote one senior official who was heavily involved in this administration's planning on nuclear issues. I quote him as saying that it was he was very critical of the Bush's administration's, the presidential decision, I think, clearly not to divulge what they knew about North Korea right away. And to carry on, as Rice was doing, carry on in the same old way, he thought it was reckless. because, as he said to me, the most dangerous country in the world in terms of spreading fissile material to Al-Qaeda is Pakistan. And
what about that? I mean, you have the U.S. now saying, once again, reviving this idea that Saddam Hussein is working with Al-Qaeda. Perhaps Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein, you couldn't have bigger enemies. But you report there is a lot of Al-Qaeda sympathy within the Pakistani Atomic Energy Commission.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. But and also, you also should know that it's sort of interesting that Iraq, for example, when it comes to this gut issue between India and Pakistan over Kashmir, that much, you know, that dispute that's going to get us all in trouble. If we, you know, it's heating up again, by the way. And the Indians are very testy about what the Pakis are doing in terms of infiltrating terrorists into Kashmir, continuing to do so. But Saddam has always sided with India on the dispute with Pakistan. He's decided, he's always sided with India, and it was sort of amazing because that's an absolute, the opposite of what you would expect if he was in any way involved with Al-Qaeda, because the Indian Indian Kashmir issue is one of Osama bin Laden's, you know, major four or five. He's, you know, he's got the American presence in Saudi Arabia, he's got the Israeli Palestinian issue, he's got and he's got the India-Pakistan issue is a very big issue for the bin Laden crowd. So the evidence, it's a case the government, the American government, has yet to make, and they're saying now they will put out more information. And I'm one of those. I'm sure there are many people in the audience, same sort of position, which is, boy, if they had something really good, it's impossible to believe we wouldn't know it already, but we have to wait and see.
Seymour Hersh, so why did the Bush administration quash the CIA report? It was released in June, remained unpublicized throughout the summer and early fall. During this time, the government laying the groundwork for war with Iraq, not wanting to say it, actually deceptively hiding this information as senators were voting on whether to authorize an attack on Iraq. Many said they would have had a different view if they understood what was going on with North Korea. Why is the Bush administration taking this route?
Well, there's an obvious answer to that question. It's a fixation with Iraq. And one of the questions, it seems to me, is the biggest problem we have in America, I think, right now is sort of the collapse of Congress, not only the Democratic Party, but this Congress as an institution. And, you know, if I were a senator running an intelligence committee and hadn't been briefed on this, I would be really upset. I would want to know why. I would be asking the same question you're asking. And it shouldn't be a Democratic-Republican issue. It should be an issue for the Congress, really, which is supposedly monitoring intelligence activities, monitoring proliferation activities. And just where are they? And, I think it's a question that, you know, that begs an answer. Why didn't the administration do something more prudently about North Korea once having gotten the document? I can understand in the spring of 2002 when there were just rumors about it and reports, okay, you don't want to act on that. But when you get an actual NIE, top secret SCI, special, you know, clearance in needed, you know, very closely held document, very sensitive. And when you get this report, and I understand it's an extensive report, 20 or so pages, that's a pretty devastating report, as I say, not only about North Korea, but about the Pakistani support for it and the implications of that. To not do something, you don't have to make it public necessarily, classified document, although they have put NIEs, declassified them, but certainly to not deal with them politically or even privately in any way or share them with Congress does raise questions that don't seem to be asked.
Seymour Hersh, I want to thank you very much for being with us. That ends the show. His piece is in last week's issue of The New Yorker, The Cold Test, What the Administration Knew About Pakistan and the North Korean Nuclear Program. Tonight, Pacifica will be broadcasting a State of the Union address, and we'll be getting response around the country to that address. Any station can take that program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Anna Noguera, Alex Wolf, Mike DeFilippo, and Rich Kim are engineers. Our website, democracynow.org. Email address mail@democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening. But he wants-